I'm curious about the second part of that. You said, you know what I mean, because I really don't.
Oh, so,
mine is
so
about minimizing harm.
The two philosophies
about feeling
violating the ethics of an individual is violating ethics regardless. And yours is minimization of harm is better. So utilitarian versus deontological. From my standpoint, committing one unethical act is a violation of principle and ethics that can't be crossed. But I will admit, there's not like a hard line.
I think that is silly, to be honest with you.
I mean, I respect you, you know, but they're very strong philosophical positions held by most people.
I believe that less suffering is better, and that I am willing to.
I will tell you something you won't like to hear, though.
I'm willing to sully myself if that's the outcome.
But I'll tell you something you're not going to want to hear, and I admit I'll call it dickish. Utilitarianism is typically the villain in most movies.
I don't care.
Utilitarianism is typically the villain in most movies.
I don't care.
Yeah, so for instance, like Thanos.
All right. my name is Ben Burgess. This is Give Them an Argument. We are kicking off season 4 with a mostly all philosophy episode before we get to the post game. I am joined, as always, by our super producer, Jake Abbott, union organizer by day, Give Them an Argument producer by night, man about town, our graphic designer, J. Andrew World, guy who makes all those wonderful thumbnails. And then not as always, by Ryan Lake, who is going to stay with us after this segment because we have Greg Caruso is going to be joining us to have a little exchange about his and Ryan's very different views about free will. Greg, for people who aren't familiar, also recently did a book of battling back and forth essays with Daniel Dennett. About the same subject, so it should be a really interesting discussion. Daniel Dennett is one of the four horsemen of, well, I guess it was New Atheism, but maybe the apocalypse. I don't think Ryan is one of the four horsemen of anything, but it's just
not yet. Aspiring.
All right, aspiring horsemen.
But by the end of the show, we should figure out what we are the four horsemen of. I'm not sure what it is yet.
Yeah. All right. Fair enough. So decide whether each of you want to be famine or death or disease, war, whatever the four horsemen are. So I was intrigued. I was watching a little bit of, I think I was actually watching clips from, I will admit I did not get through the entire 3.5 hours because I'm only human, but I was watching some clips from a recent discussion between Tim Pool and not Sam Cedar, we just watched, we're going to get back to that, but Tim Pool and Matt Binder. Which was mostly about like social media, and abortion. And it was a lot of things. But I was super intrigued because Tim mentioned the trolley problem and my nerdy little ears perked up. And I wanted to see what he had to say about that. So we're going to get to that in just a minute. That's why I asked Ryan to come early to take a look at some of these clips with us. Before that, though, I just want to say a few things right at the top of the show before we miss them. So first things first, on this Friday, the 17th, I am going to be in Baltimore, Maryland at Red Emma's, which is a worker-owned bookstore and coffeehouse in Baltimore, doing a reading and signing and Q&A about the Hitchens book. So that should be a lot of fun. That is 7 p.m. at Red Emma's in Baltimore on Friday. There is, I believe, already a link to where you could RSVP for that. Admission's free, but just trying to kind of keep track of how many people are showing up. So in the description for this episode. A week after that, Saturday the 25th, I am going to a debate in New York City at the Beacon Theater. There might actually be a second leftist in here. It's that is currently under negotiation. I've been kind of pushing for that for reasons you'll see. But right now it is with James O'Keefe, Tulsi Gabbard, me, and Tim Pool, the guy who has stuff to say about the trolley problem and Thanos and related subjects. So again, that's going to be at the Beacon Theater. I do not actually remember the start time off the top of my head, but again, the link is in the description on Saturday the 25th. And finally, the last of the big IRL things I wanted to plug on Sunday the 26th, also in New York, but this one's in Brooklyn. The Sublation Media, which people might know, our good friend Doug Lane used to be the editor of Zero Books. This is a new project. They're coming out with their first book, which is by by Norman Finkelstein. There's going to be a book launch, and I think some of it's going to be streamed, and some of it's going to be like streamed for like patrons of various things. But if you want to just show up in person, whole deal starts at 3 p.m. That's Sunday the 26th in Brooklyn. Again, I think a link to that is in the description of the episode. If it's not yet, it will be soon. I'm going to be at a panel at that, and should be a very good time. It's kind of being done jointly as like the Sublation Media book launch for Finkelstein's book, and also a live show, the first live show for the This Is Revolution podcast. It's not going to be the last one, even in the next little while. In fact, I believe the next one after that might be a joint thing with Give Them an Argument. So do hold on for more details on that. Okay, so I want to get to the utilitarianism. So let's get the first Tim Pool Matt Bender clip where they're talking about that.
I'm going to be a little bit condescending, and I'm going to point out why it's so difficult to do these shows. Seamus shows data at least from 1988. Hmm. It happened. We have edge cases that are clearly citable. We have the legal definition of abortion. We have a clear moral difference. But I'll give you an example of where I think the problem lies, and I'm going to throw it back to explain the Thanos moment with Sam Cedar. Sam doesn't know what deontology or utilitarianism is. And when I was having a conversation with him and I referenced deontological thinking versus utilitarianism, he said, I don't understand what that is. How do you explain to someone who doesn't understand these concepts what they are? How would you propose I explain deontology or utilitarianism?
I don't know.
What if I use something that is common to most people, like a movie?
I mean, if you want to do that, sure.
Maybe if I'm dealing with someone who doesn't know philosophy,
this is the thing. I understand on your show and you like to have the discussion, but I don't deal in the philosophical. I just don't. I deal with actual policy and what's actually going on and what happens to people in real life.
What do you think I mean by philosophical?
It's nice to just... opining about hypotheticals. You do that all the time.
That's not what I'm talking about.
Okay, then what?
Well, this is another really great point.
Sure.
I think that you and Sam lack the perspicacity to understand the context of the arguments and the substance of them. So in the context of Sam Cedar, I made a reference to deontology, that an immoral act against a single individual shall not be taken, versus utilitarianism, which is more the argument that the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few, which is also a pop culture reference.
It's not objectively that funny, but which is also a pop culture reference at the end of that, like, kills me every time I watch that. Ryan, do you have the perspicacity to catch his pop culture reference?
No, that's a new one to me. Too obscure.
Too obscure. Deep cut.
That's yeah, real deep cut. Real deep cut. Very few know that one.
Yeah. All right. I know there's probably some fucking Zoomers watching this who's like, oh, I don't know it. That's Star Trek when Spock sacrifices himself. Anyway, doesn't matter.
I always have students who even know that one. Like my Zoomer students, a lot of them know that. Like that's not a deep cut. Even though that's like a 40-year-old movie, like it's a very well known.
Yeah, it is very
well known reference. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it is extremely well known. I don't think you needed to say that's a pop culture reference. But in any case, all right. So Ryan, you what do you do for a living?
I'm a philosophy professor.
All right, so you have the perspicacity, so I trust you on this. Now, what he's talking about is that in the, we're going to watch a little bit of it, not actually this part, but you saw it in the cold open, right? That the, in the discussion with Sam Cedar, he brings up Thanos to illustrate utilitarianism because Thanos is killing half the population, but that's supposed to lead the remaining half to have a better life. Footnote, not sure that the utilitarian calculations work out there, but the,
I suspect they don't.
Yeah, I think you're probably leading to less happiness, actually, by murdering half of the population of the entire world, would be my suspicion. But
That seems to be what the Endgame movie showed. Like, no one seemed very happy 5 years later. So yeah, I think he did the calculation wrong, but he was acting on what he thought was the utilitarian thing.
Is that more of a like Malthusian? Is it a resource sharing thing? Never mind. I'm kind of
Thanos seemed to be a Malthusian. Yes, yes.
Yeah, that's how he explained it. You know, was it the like what does he say, like the empty bellies or something, or the mouth?
Yeah,
you
know?
Which is anyway.
Although for some reason his snap also kills off half the animals, apparently, which would seem to like defeat the point. Like, you still want the animals there to eat, but yeah, I don't know. Anyway,
yeah, I'm gonna say that Thanos is actually probably not a good utilitarian. I do not think his explanation is great, but you know, it's okay. So I think that there are gonna be some important qualifications to get into, but anyway, basically, you know, he's comparing Sam's position to Thanos, which is kind of funny, and so, you know, people had some fun with it. You saw a little bit of that in the video that we the Avengers mashup thing, you know, which we, you know, has been around for quite a while, you know, we use as part of our cold open. Tim is apparently very offended by that, that people were making light of the serious point he was making. Look, Matt Bender doesn't like philosophy. Not everybody does. I do. You know, this is give them an argument. We'll take the philosophy seriously. Let's look a little bit more into Tim's argument. Let's watch the second clip.
The idea being that we tend to see villainous people as those who are willing to sacrifice people for the sake of other people. We tend to see heroes as those who are willing to save the individual. Sam didn't know what those words meant.
Sure.
But they're hugely important to our policy in this country. The trolley problem, as it were. Is a question about whether you're willing to kill a person to save five people. These are questions of deontology versus utilitarianism. Sam doesn't know those words. And I'm not saying it to be mean to him. It's not what I'm sure. Not everybody knows philosophy. But if I'm trying to convey ideas, the only thing I can do is try to find common ground between us. Big movie just came out, Avengers. So if you don't understand deontology or utilitarianism, which is the academic approach, I can try the pop culture approach. Me, I love pop culture references. Instead of actually addressing the substance of the issue, instead, Sam and many others just mocked the idea that I had to dumb down the concepts for him because he didn't get it. You see, this is a problem. If I approach in good faith Sam with a question about philosophy that he cannot understand because he doesn't know these terms, so I try to find common ground and he mocks me for it, what is my incentive to even try?
He seems really hurt by the Thanos video.
Does, yes. Yeah. What the fuck? Try, Thanos.
Yeah. If people aren't going to appreciate my deep cut pop culture references, why even bother?
Well, you know, look, I feel his pain. I've gotten in front of Intro to Philosophy classes and referred to movies nobody's ever heard of because I'm old, you know. So I know it hurts.
Yeah, no, I'd love it if my students would make a video like that if I based on my dumb pop culture references. That'd be great.
That would actually be amazing. That's Although that might actually be an interesting difference. So something I know, Ryan, you brought up to me recently is so who are the two actors who were both watching people do impressions of them?
Oh, it was William Shatner and Jeff Goldblum. I guess there are a bunch of these, but I saw those two in particular, and they were both delightful because William Shatner was extremely offended by every impersonation of him. And Jeff Goldblum, look up the Jeff Goldblum. It's delightful. He is so enraptured by every impersonation. He's just in love with it. He's like, and he just goes on about like how much each impersonation, even the bad impersonator, he's very kind to them. He's like, oh yeah, they got this thing that I do. And they got this thing that I do. And it was just great. Yeah.
Yeah. No. And I think that might be the difference right there. I mean, I think if I, I think if I said something like a little bit silly and I'm with you, right? I mean, if I, you know, if I made some like goofy pop culture reference and like somebody like took the trouble to like do the clip of the movie with my face superimposed and like, you know, making the reference, then, you know, even if it was, I mean, at my expense, I would still find that, I think, pretty delightful, right?
Yeah. Like,
Just, I don't know. I mean, just don't. Look, okay, I understand, right? You know, you're using these terms, and I will say, you know, as one guy who likes philosophy to another, Tim, I don't generally expect people, you know, to know what deontology is, for example, right? Like, if I reference that, I explain it. I think that's a useful skill to have as a communicator. I don't know, sometimes things strike people as funny, and you know, I think you're gonna have a happier life if you roll with it. That would be my that would be my heartfelt advice to Tim Pool.
I mean, he convinced me. I thought that Sam owned him before I saw his defense, and now I realize that he owned Sam. But I mean, we're kind of dancing around the fact that I've heard the term deontological, but I wouldn't have remembered what I meant if he just.
Sure. Let's actually do that.
Yeah. Yeah. I just, because we should foreground the whole thing. The problem isn't that he's completely mischaracterizing the exchange, because the problem wasn't that he was trying to explain to Sam what these terms mean. He was using it as like a gotcha QED, because pop culture, the utilitarian is usually the villain, and that's why Sam said, you know, I don't care.
Yeah.
But, you know, we want to see some, we're going to get really mad if, let's say, you do splice up some Ben Burgess clips with like the most popular pop culture franchises of the day and post them all over TikTok as the producer. Yeah. I'm going to be furious.
Very, very.
Put on the Morbius memes.
Yeah. If you really want to own us, please do a lot of that. And make sure you mention the show every time. So.
Yeah. But sorry, let's not to derail us. I need to learn what deontology
is. Yeah. 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 Okay. So utilitarianism is. But, you know, is the view that it's a form of consequentialism. Consequentialism is the view that morality is about consequences, that actions are morally, you know, the morally right thing to do is the thing that has the best consequences. Utilitarianism specifically says the kind of consequences we're interested in are maximizing happiness and minimizing suffering. There's, I think you could probably nitpick that, but that's maybe good enough for now. Deontology is the view that there are moral rules that you should follow, even if there are bad consequences sometimes, right? That's a very quick and dirty, if anybody else wants to jump in on that.
Could you give me some pop culture references? I'm not sure I understand either of those definitions unless you connect it to Marvel. Thing.
Is there like a Stranger Things example? I haven't seen the show, but I can maybe understand that.
Okay, so Stranger Things. There's something called the Upside Down. No, I'm not doing that. Yeah. So, okay. So, so far so good. I will say, you might be a little confused though, or at least I was first time I talked about this, like, okay, but why is he bringing up utilitarianism and deontology to Sam? Right. I mean, like, to be fair to Tim Pool, I don't think even Tim Pool is just being like randomly finding people, you know, like randomly like asking guests, by the way, right? Here's a list of philosophical terms. Tell me if you know what they are, right? Like, so I went and looked up the context of this. And I think the context is really interesting, right? And you know, the reference, the trolley problem, is also slightly annoying to me because I don't get an overwhelming sense that Tim knows what the problem is supposed to be, right? You know, it's like the trolley problem. What's the problem? Right? You know, that let's just do 30 seconds on that, right? So I mean, the thing, you know, this originally comes from this paper by Philippa Foote. So it's called, was it Abortion and the Doctrine of Double Effect? I might be getting that name slightly wrong, but that's the paper. And in that paper, she has a million examples because she's making the super subtle point about the Doctrine of Double Effect, which is this principle for how to decide really difficult moral dilemmas. And she's sort of defending it for a lot of the paper, but she ends up rejecting it at the end. None of that matters for now. The key thing is this example that she has. That's the Foote quote. So Edward is the driver of a trolley whose brakes have just failed. On the track ahead of him are five people. The banks are so steep, they're not able to get off the track in time. The hare has a spur leading off to the right, and Edward can turn the trolley onto it. Unfortunately, there's one person on the right-hand track. Edward can turn the trolley, killing one, or he can refrain from turning the trolley, killing the five. Foote thinks it's obvious that that this is the right thing to do, right? Although she contrasts it with some cases where, you know, similar things might not be right, but, you know, she thinks this is obviously the right thing to do. So far, there's no trolley problem. There's just a trolley example. The actual problem comes from a paper by Judith Jarvis Thompson. Thompson wrote a zillion papers about this. I think this is the first one. You know, somebody finds out I'm wrong about that, you know, go ahead and correct me. But it's called Killing, Letting Die, the Trolley Problem. And as far as I know, this is the first place the phrase problem is introduced. And she has this other example. This is the Thompson quote. George is on a footbridge over the trolley tracks. He knows trolleys, and he can see that the one approaching the bridge is out of control. On the track back of the bridge, there are five people. The banks are so steep, they will not be able to get off the track in time. George knows that the only way to stop an out-of-control trolley is to drop a very heavy weight onto the path, but the only available sufficiently heavy weight is a fat man also watching the trolley from the footbridge. George can shove the fat man onto the track in the path of the trolley, or can refrain from doing this, letting the five die. All right, so the problem is supposed to be, why is it that the first one seems okay and the second one doesn't? Right? That's the problem. That intuitively it seems like the right thing to do to turn the track, doesn't seem like the right thing to do to push the man. Although I can't think about that quote without thinking about an intro to philosophy class I taught at the University of Miami many years ago, where I remember there were these two girls who were leaving class, and this is like the most Miami conversation I ever overheard. You know, one of them turns to the other, and was like, I don't know, I mean, if he's that fat, you know, man, how great was his life anyway? Most of us think that would be bad. All right. Importantly, for where we're going with this, the problem is supposed to be why it is that this one, even though the trade-off kind of seems the same, this one thing seems, you know, seems to be morally wrong in a way that the other one doesn't, right? So it's not like Thompson thinks that anytime you're ever doing anything, even the teensy tiniest bit sorted, in order to try to minimize harm, you're doing something wrong, right? That's not the point. The point is that there are certain very specific, there are certain kinds of things you can do in that aim that nevertheless seem wrong. And the question is how to figure out the principles that guide those decisions, which very small pedantic pet peeve, but you know, 99% of the time I see people use the phrase the trolley problem. They don't quite seem to get that that's the problem. Okay, with that said, let's watch. I'm going to try to do this quickly because Greg was supposed to come on at 8:30, and I want to get to that in the next few minutes. We're running a little bit late, but I do want to just show this. So this is just a little sample of the stuff, the part of Tim Pool's conversation with Sam Cedar before he brings up deontology and utilitarianism and, you know, all and Thanos and all that stuff to give you the context for why he's bringing it up.
In the democracy, the hardest choice in the world is to choose between two, the lesser of two evils.
Well, the fact is that
You can vote for somebody who has no chance of winning, but it's more or less the exact same act. You're just, might as well go out and take the middle.
I'm supporting Tulsi and to a lesser extent, Andrew Yang. And so either one of them will get my vote.
And I think, but I'm talking about the general election. I mean,
I'm going to vote for either of them, no matter what happens. Well, I might vote for myself. I'm more of a like a union collective bargaining type mentality in that we must stand up and strike against whatever, even if we're on the losing side.
Well,
right?
I agree with the idea of withholding your labor, but the fact is that voting is not about your labor. It is it is simply a number.
I don't mean that. I mean like if you're at work and you had two managers and you were getting stiffed on pay, and one said, I'll cut your hours, but I'll give you better healthcare. And the other said, no, I'll give you the healthcare, but you got to work, you know, extra hours. Or you could strike and say, no, give me what I want. Right.
Yeah.
I'm not going to choose.
Withholding your labor against the capitalist class is a far different dynamic than wasting your vote. It just simply is.
Well, so hold on. Like, which Democrat would I vote for? You know what I mean?
The one who is the nominee.
No, absolutely not. Biden? No way.
Let me
think. Kamala Harris? No way. She locked up innocent people, man. That's nuts. Tulsi Gabbard, a major in the National Guard with real military experience, who is anti-war.
I'm not telling you who to vote for in the primary, but the fact of the matter is that if Kamala Harris does not win the nomination, she, writing her in is useless act.
Would you vote for Kamala Harris if she got the nomination?
I would vote against Donald Trump.
But Kamala Harris locked up innocent people.
I am aware of that. Donald Trump.
I mean,
Donald Trump.
He has
literally kidnapped children who will never be reunited with their parents. They are in foster homes and they will never be reunited.
I mean, there's an entirely more complicated issue. You know, what's going on with the border.
What I just told you is perfectly clear.
Okay. So that's the context, right? I want to be everybody super clear on this, because this is why all of this stuff about utilitarianism, deontology, and the trolley problem, the context for the whole thing is, you just saw in that clip, Tim telling Sam that I'm not going to, you know, if it's anybody but Tulsi Gabbard and Andrew Yang, you know, if it's anybody but those two people, which, you know, by the way, this, like, Bernie Sanders was in that election, but somehow Tulsi Gabbard and Andrew Yang, those are you guys. But anyway, whatever. If it's anybody but them, he wouldn't vote for the Democratic nominee against Trump. He also wouldn't vote for Trump because he's not going to choose the lesser evil, because the lesser evil is still evil. And it's all pushing the fat man onto the trolley track. It's all, you know, Thanos snapping his fingers and murdering half the population of the entire human race and animals. It's all on that level. But it's all objectionable on that level. Just, you know, voting for the, you know, like making a, you know, harm minimization decision in a swing state, you know, you might as well be wiping out half of the human race. And we know that the focusing on minimizing harm is bad, because that reminds me of utilitarianism. Utilitarianism reminds me of the bad guys in the movies. Okay. That's the argument. And there's a lot we can say about this argument, but I do just want to, like, there is a, you know, all right, so we watched the pool Binder stuff where they're talking about all, you know, trolley problem and utilitarianism and everything. We watched, you know, both the, you know, the funny part, you know, that we did as the cold open and also the context of it. But there is something really important that happened in between those. So do we have our Tim Pool solo clip? So this is Tim Pool. Remember, he gave three options for what he was going to do in the general election. You know, if Tulsi or Yang wasn't nominated. Write in Tulsi, write in Andrew Yang, or vote for himself. So, if anybody wants to take a quick, you know, write down their answer or whatever, you know, which of these they think he did, let's watch and see what he actually decided to do. The context of this clip is he's just finished reading off Donald Trump's like website where he lists his where he says this is my second term agenda, and it's all stuff like I'm going to create jobs and make sure that we get back to normal after COVID, and it's all super vague about how it's going to happen. But that's what he's just finished reading off. Here's the clip.
For this, but I will tell you what, I believe that any rational American would look at this and say, yeah, I you know, look, I'm sorry to a lot of people. Maybe it's boring to read through Trump's agenda item list, but I'm like 90% there on what Trump is proposing right now. I agree. I have my concerns for sure. But I will tell you that with the Democrats' insanity, with the ongoing riots, with the endorsement of much of this violence, with these far leftists getting on board with the violence, I got to say, I will take Trump any day over these other groups.
You know, you got to give it to the beanie. there's a really powerful mind working under there.
What happened to the deontological duty not to support someone who locked up innocent people? That's just gone now?
I guess. yeah, I mean, like, he thinks that he thinks Donald Trump is going to, you know, create jobs and, I don't know, make, you know, restore order after the, you know, riots that were going on in summer 2020. And, you know, if a few kids are going to be put in cages at the other end of that equation, then, you know, so be it.
Sounds so, like Thanos reasoning to me.
Yeah, that was my take on this. It's like, okay, yeah. Look, let's run with, for the sake of argument, the idea that making a harm minimization decision in like the ballot box and, you know, and like whatever. I don't, you know, if somebody tells me they don't want to do that, I'm not going to like denounce them. I don't going to say they're a horrible person. I get it, right? I understand why you might not want to do that. If you live in a swing state and you want my advice, I'll give you my advice. But, mm-hmm. you know, look, if people aren't excited about going out and voting for Democrats, the Democrats should nominate better people and get them more excited, right? That's on them. But the, but I don't actually think making a harm minimization decision in a swing state voting booth is similar to Thanos snapping his fingers. I actually think they're morally relevant disanalogies between those two cases. Let's run with it for the sake of argument that, you know, that Kant would say that you have to write in Tulsi Gabbard. I don't actually think so, but, you know, let's just pretend yes, right? But if you're a real deontology guy, you got to write in Tulsi or Gabbard or Tim Pool. Those are your choices. Okay. Well, if so, I mean, who's Thanos now, motherfucker?
Yep.
I just, you know, if he's going to bring it up and act all aggrieved about it, you know, it's like I was making this very serious point about how harm reduction in an election is bad because it's something a utilitarianism might support. Utilitarianism reminds me of the bad guys in the movie. They're just going to make stupid jokes about it. And, you know, damn it, I was making a really important point. It's like, okay, but you yourself didn't stick with that point, right? You abandoned that point. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah. In a really awful way. I mean, it was like, oh, Thanos only wants to wipe out half of the human race, but I think we could go to 60%, right? Like, let's let's see if we can get those numbers up.
Yep. Yeah, pretty amazing.
All right. I'm, you know, all right. So the pieces of advice for Tim Pool. Don't throw around specialized vocabulary without like front-loaded the explanation when you're talking to non-specialists. That's just, you know, I mean, if you want to do popular philosophy, which I want more of, right? And I'm glad that he wants to do it. But if you want to do popular philosophy, you can't be doing that.
That's especially when you're doing it the way he's doing it to like score a point. Like then you make academics look like assholes when you do that kind of thing. Like, yeah. Don't do that.
Yeah, exactly. Right. definitely don't do that. Right. I mean, I think it's actually on you to show that what you're trying to communicate is important. And you don't do that by using it as a test, right? You know, does everybody already know what I'm talking about? So that's the first one. Second one is try to enjoy it. You know, when people milk humor for these things, you'll have a much happier life. Third one is, if you're going to call people Thanos for voting for the lesser evil, don't vote for the greater evil. Yeah. Those are my takes. Anybody else have anything they want to throw in for Tim before we finish up with this?
Yeah, maybe take a 201 class because you seem to be okay with a 101 class, but you know, let's
you know, also,
oh, go ahead, Ryan.
My only tip is don't pretend like you're offering really clever, deep pop culture references when you're quoting like the most famous Star Trek quote of all time. Like maybe the second most favorite. Live Long and Prosper is probably the most favorite. But
Good for obscure stuff. Like, I hope you know, the force be with you.
I hope you live long and prosper, Sam, which by the way
is a pop culture reference.
It's a pop culture reference.
Help you understand.
That's right.
Exactly. All right. Well, so I will see Jake and Andy in the post game for patrons. A reminder, if you have not signed up on the Patreons, patreon.com/BenBurgess, you can check out tonight's post game with those two gentlemen and also Dr. Kuba and Jason Miles for This Is Revolution. We're going to look at, we're going to do a lot of fun stuff in the post game. But right now, I am very excited about having a conversation, which I think I'm actually going to have the least to say, because two of these guys just know more about it than I do, and have written much more extensively about it and so on. So Ryan, you already know, and we also have Greg Caruso. So Greg, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, Greg.
Hey, Brian. How you doing?
Good. How you doing?
Good.
All right. So I should say Greg is the author, co-author of a couple of books. There's one called Rejecting Retributivism, which I'm sure that'll come up very quickly. There's also, we alluded to earlier, a book of kind of battling back and forth essays with Daniel Dennett called Just Desserts, Debating Free Will. And some of Greg's views about this came up a little bit at the last season. We had David Pizarro from Very Bad Wizards on, and we were talking about kind of Gia Cohen and free will and related subject, you know, related subjects. But Greg, what is your basic view about all of this stuff?
Well,
I know that's a giant. That's a giant. Let me try to.
It's easy enough. I'm a free will skeptic, so I deny. Well, basically, I maintain that who we are and what we do is ultimately the result of factors beyond our control, and we could talk about what kind of factors those might be. And because of that, we're never morally responsible in a really particular sense, the kind of sense that most philosophers debate. It's sometimes called the basic dessert sense. Basically, it's the sense that would make you truly deserving of praise and blame and punishment and reward and certain types of reactive attitudes like resentment and indignation and moral anger. It's also the kind of moral responsibility that's needed to justify things like retributive punishment. So basically, I say agents do not have this kind of free will or moral responsibility. And I define philosophers have to define their terms. And so I define free will as the control and action that's required for this kind of responsibility. Mm-hmm. And it's a pretty standard way of defining it, especially among philosophers that write about free will. And I argue that we just lack this kind of control because ultimately who we are and what we do is the result of these factors that drain back the sources antecedent to the agent. And are ultimately beyond the control of the agent.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, let's just so everybody knows where everybody stands. Ryan has written a couple things about this, including a award-winning doctoral dissertation. So that was I think that was actually really useful for contrast, right? Especially with the digging of the definition, because I think there actually is going to be a shared definition here. But Ryan, what's your view about free will?
So I do work with the same, like Greg said, the common definition of free will is what is the kind of control that's necessary to have real moral responsibility. And so I have a view, and a lot of your viewers already know this, but my view is a view called compatibilism. So I'm in the camp. So I'm opposed to Greg in a couple of ways. But there's some things we have in common too. But the big thing is that while I agree that, you know, I'm not, you know, bringing anything non-naturalist or supernatural or, contra-causal, but what compatibilists argue is that, even if the universe is completely causally deterministic and physical or whatever, or even if you throw in indeterminism in ways that probably don't make a difference on compatibilist views, that we can still have kinds of control. And that's something skeptics will agree with. They'll agree that there are kinds of control we can have even if determinism is true. But the big thing for compatibilists is they'll say the kinds of control and the kinds of abilities we have to reflect on our reasons and shape our characters over time can be sufficient for us to have to ground real moral responsibility. So basically that the kind of free will that we can have, even if determinism is true, is really this responsibility and desert grounding kind of free will.
Right. So why don't we, I'm trying to think about what the most useful way into this is. You know, I guess maybe it would be for Ryan to just say a little bit more about what, you know. Okay, so you both think that you know the kind of free will that you're interested in is whatever kind of control we would have to have over our actions in order for moral responsibility to make sense, right? You know, in order for you to, you know, to be at fault. Right, you know, morally at fault if you do it, you know, something wrong, or you know, the opposite of that. If you do something right, so you know, maybe so the issue has got to be like what that would be, right? I mean, what kind of control would be, you know, necessary for that? I mean, I think we kind of got a little bit from Greg by implication, right? You know, like. What he thinks it would have to be, you know, given what he's denying, but maybe we could just do. Oh, sorry. Do you want to throw in?
Well, no, I there are different ways you could go about it. I mean, for me, the kind of clearest way. So there's basically what I try to do as a free will skeptic is look at all of the different views that could preserve this kind of control and action. And I argue that each fails for different reasons. And as an end result, free will skepticism is the only sort of rational position left standing. And I think, you know, one way to start is to say that Ryan and I agree on why some of the other accounts fail, I would imagine. Yeah. So he's a compatibilist, I'm a free will skeptic. As such, I think we would probably agree that certain libertarian accounts fail. Mm-hmm. Libertarian here doesn't mean the political view of libertarianism. This is a kind of metaphysical view about free will. And so, basically it says that for agents to have the kind of control and action, their actions have to be causally undetermined. And then there are different ways they cash that out. I mean, I don't want to get too technical, but it breaks into two general kind of camps. One that posits these indeterminacies just at the level of events. So at the level of events, you might say maybe at the quantum level, there's some fundamental indeterminacy. And then there's another kind called agent causation that introduces more robust notions of agency, where an agent could be the cause of their own actions, but themselves uncaused. They could kind of create ex nihilo out of nothing. And I think each of these fails for different reasons. And I think Ryan and I probably agree about that.
Yeah.
Well, let's maybe slow down on that a little bit, right? Because I think a lot of people who are maybe just a little bit familiar with this stuff, I think that's the kind of free will that they're imagining is mostly under discussion, right? Is something like this, right? So let's.
That's probably true.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I think let's start with. I mean, does one of you want to just say like, you know, let's start with the event. You know, event causal libertarianism, right? So, like, what do people with this position think is going on? Like, when we make a free decision, it has to be going on for us to make a free decision.
I'll take a stab. So the version of this I'm most familiar with, but is Robert Kane. He's probably the most popular version of this model. But a lot of other people, like John Lemos and some other people, have developed similar kinds of views. Bolger. So the basic idea is that they want to argue on these event causal views. They want it to be scientifically respectable. They're not trying to bring in souls or robust agents or anything metaphysical. So what they want to argue is that that quantum indeterminacies can work their way into our decision-making process in such a way that you can avoid some of the arguments for that motivate incompatibilism. You can still have free will. So on Kane's basic model, the way he argues it is it might be the case that maybe most of our choices are causally determined by what's going on at the brain at a given moment. But he says there are these key moments, what he calls self-forming actions, where the agent will be torn between two choices. So they'll be really motivated. So his example is like a businesswoman who's on her way to like an important meeting. Mm-hmm. And she passes by someone who's being mugged in the alley. So she has a choice. She can either stop and help the person or she can go on to the meeting. And so we imagine that she's really torn here. So she like has motives and desires and interests in helping the person. She also has motives and desires driving and reasons driving her to go to the meeting. And so Kane suggests without too much evidence, but he suggests that in this moment, the brain might end up in this kind of chaotic state where it's sensitive to these very minor quantum fluctuations. So where the choice could really go either way. And so he says, so the choice really could go either way. It's not causally determined by your background, by your genes, by the laws of physics, by the Big Bang. We can't predict what's going to happen. But whatever happens, the choice is going to be something that was a product of the businesswoman's beliefs and desires and reasons and cognitive capacities. So this is a way he wants to like avoid the problem of determinism and still have like a respectable account of free choice without bringing anything metaphysical in. Did I do justice to that?
That's exactly. I would just add too. Yeah. The quantum indeterminacies also have to percolate up to the level of neural networks. And he has this kind of, what I've attacked as well is kind of a controversial notion of dual willings. You have to will both outcomes simultaneously, which is sort of strange, both phenomenologically. We don't typically feel ourselves sort of willing. Yeah. And it's not exactly the example of a kind of rational agent willing P and not P simultaneously.
So
my basic argument against that kind of view is that the agent would lack the ability to settle which outcome ultimately occurs. So it's an issue of settling. And so settling for me is a kind of control in action. It's a kind of robust control in action. And it's a kind of control in action that'd be needed for agents to be responsible for these outcomes. And in the event causal indeterminist account, all causation happens at the level of events. And if true indeterminacy is involved in this proximal chain just prior to action, the agent really doesn't settle which outcome. They will both outcomes simultaneously. Yeah. And then it's a matter of indeterminacy, which one actually wins out. So like if you were to rewind time and replay it over and over again, you get this probabilistic set of outcomes probably
So I did just want to highlight, right, because I think I've heard at least two, you know, objections, and I think even though, you know, we haven't gotten really to you know, the what either of you think yet, but I think the reason this is worth maybe taking a second on is that if you want to, you know, I mean, if you want to say that, you know, we have that kind of free will that you would need to, you know, determinism to be false, you know, to have that, you know, and you want to, you know, you don't want to say anything too weird or supernatural or whatever, right? This seems like a pretty good candidate, but there are at least two kinds of problems here. One, Ryan kind of hinted at this, you know, there's no particular reason to think this happens. Right, I mean, like that's like, it's, you know, you're taking a sort of like, well, if the physics turns out just right, right, and then not just the physics, but the, you know, neuroscience and whatever.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, we don't really even know if quantum mechanics is really indeterministic, for starters. So
like, it's like, okay, if you assume a lot of things, you probably, that are very much like up in the air and like it doesn't seem like very safe assumptions, then maybe it works this way. Right. That's one worry. But then the other one, and I think, you know, is going to be maybe even more important, you know, is what Greg said, you know, I think with the thing about settling. So, and I'm not sure if this is exactly the same point or not, but it's like that look, if you are conflicted about something and ultimately there's some kind of like quantum coin flip in your brain, then, you know, just intuitively the objection is okay, but I didn't decide which of those two things would happen, right? You know, this physical process that's ultimately outside of my control, even if it's, you know, even if it's indeterministic decided it.
Yeah, if I could expand on it. Sure. So I think those are two objections. There are actually probably more. I've raised more in my work, but just to focus on those two, regarding the first one, the kind of empirical constraint. The theory makes posits all kinds of things, and none of the people who defend the theory actually suggest the world works this way. As you said, yeah. Ben, they're just trying to set out in a possible naturalistic account of free will that can conceivably be true and isn't yet disproven by science. That's sort of what the goal is. In fact, one of the main proponents of this view, Al Mealy, has a version of this account, but doesn't endorse it as true, in part because we don't have any evidence the brain works this way. So not only do indeterminacies have to really exist, quantum mechanics has to be fundamentally, you know, indeterministic, they have to exist at the right neural level. Oh yeah, also they have to be able to percolate up to the level of neural networks. Oh yeah, also they have to occur at exactly the right temporal moment in time, the moment after you will bolt inconsistent outcomes. And we have no evidence to think any of that is true, and probably good reason to think none of that is going to actually turn out to be the case. The more philosophical objection is the settling objection. Sometimes it's called the disappearing agent objection, or even the luck objection, is that the agent disappears at the crucial moment. They disappear at exactly the moment when the outcome or the behavior has to be settled, right? When the agent has to decide, the businesswoman has to decide to go to the meeting or help the person in need. And so sometimes, you know, people put this as an objection of luck. I see the disappearing agent objection, the luck objection, to be subclasses of each other, but slightly distinct. Mm-hmm. There are other problems with the theory as well, just to throw in a few more. The concept of dual willings seems to not fit with our traditional understanding of rational agency. And just to get back to the kind of moral part, just imagine this, like I go to some conference and I'm not this kind of person, but just to say I was, some beautiful woman is flirting with me, and I simultaneously will to give in to temptation and simultaneously will to remain faithful to my wife. According to Cain, this felt indeterminacy corresponds to some real indeterminacy in my brain that percolate up to the level of neural networks. So one represents the will to give in to temptation, one represents the will to remain faithful. And ultimately, which occurs is a matter of a quantum flipping of a coin. So let's say I remain faithful. And I go home to my wife and I say, hey, you know what? I willed to cheat on you, but I quantum indeterminacy settled that I deserve praise.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone would think that in that situation, deserve to be praised for remaining faithful when I willed to not be faithful. Mm-hmm. And it was a matter of quantum outcomes that I did remain faithful.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a nice point. Yes. Yeah. And yeah, so yeah, I kind of see the luck objection, the disappearing objection a little differently. So I'm less concerned about the luck objection, as you can probably guess. And I'm sure we'll get into the luck problem. But there, the disappearing agent really does, like, even in a compatibilist sense, like the agent just vanishes, like that nothing in the agent's intentional states or beliefs or desires settles what happens. It just happens independently of anything the agent does. And that seems like not a good model for a free choice.
Yeah, I mean, you can kind of imagine the you know, I don't know. It's like there was a Community episode where they have like this they're rolling this many sided die and it like branches off into alternate universes for all the outcomes, right? Yeah. You know, it's like there's something like, you know, patting yourself on the back because you're in the universe where it split off into the one where you didn't do it. Seems like
right.
Okay, so fair enough. Let's talk maybe just real quickly, just to, you know, canvas a few of the big options about the other kind of libertarianism. So, you know, so Greg, you mentioned earlier, right? You know, there's like event causal libertarianism and there's agent causal libertarianism, which is supposed to get around some of these problems.
Right. So I actually think agent causal libertarianism would provide us with the control and action needed for basic deserved moral responsibility. I just think that we have good reason to think we are not agent causal, you know, agents, in the sense that agent causal libertarianism requires some really robust metaphysical commitments that I think are hard to defend and justify given our best philosophical and scientific theories about the world. So my objections to agent causal libertarianism,
well, again, sorry, before we do the objections, I just want to make sure everybody knows what we're talking about. So
in this case, the agent is a substance, not an event. And they have certain unique causal powers. They have the ability to cause physical events in the world, but they themselves are causally undetermined. So basically, you, the agent, you, Ben, or you, Ryan, are the cause of your actions, but you're completely undetermined by all these antecedent events, your childhood, your brain chemistry. But that requires a kind of agency that is, and that the agent has this kind of sui generis ability, this kind of ability to cause physical events without being causally determined, requires the agent to not be determined by their brain events. That is, I, Greg Caruso, am not just what neurons are firing or what chemicals are being released in my brain, what synapses, you know, are being triggered in this particular event, because those all involve event causal sequences that presumably would be determined by the laws of, you know, neurobiology and physics and chemistry. So the agent has to be the substance that makes you the agent, has to not be completely determined by those lower level physical events. They have to be either some kind of an emergent agent, and I mean a radically emergent agent, and not just like a prosaic kind of acceptable kind of emergence, a kind of more radical emergence, where a new substance emerges at this higher level that's distinct and can't be determined by the lower level activities. We have no reason to think that agents are those kind of things. It violates certain kinds of scientific principles I think could be defended, like physical causal closure, that if any event is caused in the physical realm, it's any that event's causes have to themselves be physical events. It also probably suffers from the luck objection. Some, like Al Mealy, argues that it doesn't really get around the luck, seemingly gets around the luck objection, but it's unclear that it does. And it's also hard to see how this would be reconciled with any understanding of the physical laws of nature, whether those physical laws be deterministic or indeterministic. Because if they were indeterministic laws of nature, And they were genuine probabilities. You would say that given a certain number of flippings of the coin, you should see this distribution. So let's say the probability should be 32% of the time you get this outcome, and this percentage you get this outcome. Well, the agent causal theorist has to be able to posit that agents could cause actions in ways that disrupt those probabilistic outcomes. That is, I should be able to do things that I'm not determined by even probabilistic laws of nature. Mm-hmm. In which case, then, what the agent does either has to violate those fundamental laws of nature, or you have to posit somehow consistencies that are beyond credibility. You have to say that there's just turns out that they correlate, that agents just happen to pick that outcome 32% of the time. But we don't have any evidence that that's the case, and we have no evidence that they violate the fundamental laws of nature. So either way, it seems kind of be empirically, falsifiable in a certain way.
Yeah. So I just want to make sure that everybody is following the thread of this. So yeah, they have it's okay. I'm just paranoid. I don't want to be like Tim Pool. So I have a one way of framing this is you say, okay, look. Agent causal libertarianism says, no, it's not some quantum coin flip in my head that's causing the thing. It's me. I'm causing it, right?
Yeah.
Okay, but what is me, right? Like, what would me have to be, right, for this to get around physical determinism, right? It would have to either be that somehow, right, I'm like a little, I'm like a little unmoved mover, right? I'm doing like kind of what God is supposed to do, right? You know, creating things without being created, right? You know, they have
you have godlike powers on this account.
Either I have godlike powers to cause effects in the physical world without my action, without my decisions themselves being traceable back to those, or maybe physical, maybe it's just that every time I make a decision, right? I could do A, I could do B. If I do A, it just so happens that A was what was physically determined to happen, which would mean that, I don't know. I mean,
coincidence is beyond.
Yeah. I mean, what's the number of free actions, what's the number of actions of the kind that, if any actions are free, right. We would hope would be included in those, right. What are the number of decisions that somebody makes in like one day multiplied by however many billion people in the world? This is a lot of like weird cosmic coincidences going on.
For your listeners, if they're familiar at all with dualism or Descartes was a dualist who believed the mind was distinct from the body and that we were made up of two different substances, one being physical material substances that are extended in space and time and have mass and location. Oh, and we're also minds, non-physical, non-material substances that are not extended in space. Descartes was a libertarian. Now, not all libertarians have to be dualists, but dualism is one way you free the agent from the deterministic laws of nature. Now, one really famous problem for that view, which is another objection.
And just parenthetically, in some ways, it'd be even weirder if you're not a dualist, right? Like, you have, like it's just your physical brain for some reason is immune from normal laws of causation.
Yeah. And I would say, one common problem in that dualism is how to explain the interaction between these physical material substances and non-physical, Descartes said, pineal gland, which was hilarious for a number of reasons. He gave us a where when we need a how. He gave us it happens at the pineal gland. And second, there's no reason to think the pineal gland is that significant. So it's kind of, it missed the mark on two accounts. But that problem actually still exists for agent causal libertarians. And I argue in my first book, actually also in the Rejecting Retributivism, that they have a hard time accounting for mental causation. And one of the reasons is that they posit a kind of metaphysical substance that's hard to explain how mental causation would occur in any way that, doesn't just posit, mysteries or godlike abilities.
Right. Okay. So we've got, if you think that we have free will, which we're all using to be, the cottage rules require for more responsibility. We've gone through a couple of different libertarian ways of making sense of that. Libertarian in the context just meaning the kind of free will that, you know, would be incompatible with determinism, has, you know, much more honorable form of libertarianism than the other kind. And then...
But I think it came first.
Yes, that's true. That's true. That's true. But one issue, not the only issue, there are also worries about luck, but one issue about both of those is that they seem to postulate just things about the way that the physical world, which human brains are part of, work, that just don't seem to, you know, seem like they're probably false given everything that we know about how the physical world works. So this would be a good time, I think, to go through, we'll just pick one very specific kind of compatibilism, the one that we have a representative of with us right now. So Ryan, do you have a way of making sense of the control condition of moral responsibility? Because this is what I actually want to see you guys argue about, that doesn't violate anything about how the physical world seems to work, and what is it, and why do you think that's good enough for moral responsibility?
There are actually a lot of accounts that are kind of influential to me, but I'll pick one that's been very influential, which is this view by John Martin Fisher and Mark Revisa, which characterizes the kind of control we need in terms of responsiveness to reasons. The very basic idea is that there is a kind of control that we have, even if everything is causally determined. And so who we are is ultimately traceable back to our early upbringing, the laws of physics and our genes and whatever. We still have this ability to recognize, understand and react, at least to some degree, to guide our behavior in accordance with reasons. And specifically for moral responsibility, I can understand and react to moral reasons. Assuming I'm a basically competent, non-sociopathic adult, I can understand the moral reasons not to commit murder. I can understand the moral reasons not to steal. And if for whatever reason I succumb to temptation, steal something or do something I know that I shouldn't do, then I can be expected to answer and held to account for what I did. But most of the time, you know, being a competent adult, I can be motivated by an understanding, guide my behavior in response to those reasons. So that's just like a very quick thumbnail sketch of the kind of control that I think is important for moral responsibility. I think sufficient for moral responsibility, though, of course, Greg will disagree. And then why this kind of account is important or necessary for responsibility. So there's another a big tradition which I, Fisher, Revisa, a lot of skeptics are influenced by, which is P.F. Strawson. So P.F. Strawson, the way he characterizes moral responsibility is in terms of the reactive attitudes. So kind of like the place I like to start is to look at our personal relationships. And so the kinds of things, like if I'm dealing with a friend or a family member, or even just an acquaintance with whom I have a relationship and certain moral expectations, assuming they're a competent adult and they can guide their behavior by reasons, and then they transgress against me, it seems appropriate for me to have certain attitudes towards them, what Strawson calls the reactive attitudes. So it seems appropriate for me to get angry or be resentful or demand an apology, maybe inflict some sort of consequences, shaming or withdrawing my friendship or whatever. And those reactions seem appropriate, and they seem appropriate precisely because the other agent had this kind of control that I'm talking about. They understood the nature of their action. They had the ability to guide their action by reasons. So it's appropriate for me to hold them to account for what they did in this kind of way.
I do just want to interject for 10 seconds to say that, yeah, just so nobody gets this wrong, right? Like, yeah, on your account, what you're definitely not saying is, I mean, it might be true, but it's not what you're saying, that it'll have like good consequences if people, you know, I don't know, can somehow make themselves have this these reactions, or, you know, they pretend to have those reactions or whatever, right? That it'll be like, you know, that there's some sort of like utilitarian reason to do this. That's not the point.
That's not my view. Yeah. So, I mean, and so that's a whole big can of worms. So a lot of compatibilists have tended to defend these views on consequentialist grounds. And then of course, and Greg has critiques of that, you know, to say that's not real responsibility if it's just a consequentialist consideration. Yeah.
Which I will say, I kind of agree with him about, but that doesn't really seem like what we're looking for. Like, right. I mean, if there are good consequences, if I act irresponsible, fine. But I mean, that's not, I think what we're really talking about whether you are responsible.
That's right. Yeah. So I mean, in my view, it's just these things feel appropriate. Just there's kind of constitutive of what it is to have relationships with people and what it is to be a human being in a society and in relationships engaged with other people, that these attitudes are sort of constitutive of that. And so there's their value is intrinsic and appropriate, and their appropriateness is intrinsic on my view. I mean, that's kind of a thumbnail sketch of the kind of view that I defend. Yeah.
All right. I think for the next few minutes, I'd like to largely fade into the background. Greg, you want to take it from there?
Yeah, sure. I mean, thanks, Ryan. That's a good summary of the position. I mean, on the one hand, at least, Ryan's a real compatibilist. In the book with Dennett, we get into this problem about the consequentialist defense. And so I don't have to get into that today. Thank you.
Yeah. I just reread that book and I was like, I love Dennett. Like I value so much of what he does, but it was frustrating by the end. You trying to pin down exactly what
he's doing. Yeah. And I get frustrated. So let me start with some points of agreement. I mean, I think the first thing is, as a free will skeptic, we don't have to deny that these compatibilist distinctions are relevant. I think the difference between agents who are reasons responsive and agents who are not reasons responsive is an important one. I think the difference between someone suffering from a severe mental disability versus a competent agent is a morally relevant distinction and plays important roles both in criminal justice and interpersonal affairs. What I disagree with is that these are enough or sufficient to ground the kind of moral responsibility that's under dispute. So there's two ways, people tend to argue against compatibilism. I'll just mention them and then say which one I prefer. There's two different ways to argue. One is that determinism, if it were true, would be inconsistent with compatibilism because it rules out the ability to do otherwise. And sometimes it's called leeway in compatibilism. So it says, well, if determinism is true, when I chose to pick this shirt or when I chose what to eat for breakfast, I couldn't have chosen a different shirt. I couldn't have chosen something different if determinism is true, where determinism is the thesis that events in the remote past in conjunction with the laws of nature entail is only one fixed future. And if there's only one fixed future, there's no forking paths. What the agent does is the only thing they could have done. And hey, is that, you know, that doesn't really preserve the kind of free will we care about. I used to be enamored with those kind of arguments. I've tended not to defend them anymore because defending the ability to do otherwise has gotten extremely difficult in the philosophical literature. And there's this whole thing coming out of Harry Frankfurt and a literature that's created epicycles among epicycles. And if you go down that rabbit hole, it's really, I don't think the Harry Frankfurt stuff works in the end, but his attempt was to argue that this ability to do otherwise is not necessary for free will. So what I tend to do is go the other way, and this is what's called sourcing compatibilism. It says that if determinism is true, the agent ultimately isn't the source of their actions in an appropriate sense because the source drains back to antecedent events that predate the agent or even go back to the Big Bang, let's say. So the best way I think to run my argument against compatibilism, and it's not my argument, it's a very standard argument against compatibilism, is to defend what's known as the manipulation argument. And so there are different ways you could run this argument, but the basic idea is if you have an agent And this agent is causally determined by, say, a team of neuroscientists. Let's say they have some device implanted in their brain, and this could be controlled remotely, let's say, by a team of neuroscientists. And these neuroscientists manipulate the person's brain, but they manipulate the person in a way that is consistent and satisfies all the compatibilist conditions for free will. That is, the agent is responsive to reasons. They're not coerced in the way that, you know, someone who is a kleptomaniac would be coerced to steal versus an agent who's not a kleptomaniac. They satisfy all the conditions. And let's say the team of neuroscientists directly manipulate this person, causing in them an egoistic desire. And this egoistic desire determines that they choose to kill some individual for personal gain. Most people have the intuition that this individual is not free, or in the sense that's needed for this kind of robust moral responsibility. Because they say, well, the agent was successfully manipulated by this team of neuroscientists and therefore shouldn't be blamed in this basic sense, or, you know, punished in a retributive sense because they were ultimately manipulated. And then the argument essentially proceeds to say that, and they could do this through sequencing cases. Sometimes with Peerboom has this four-case manipulation argument where he starts with this overt kind of manipulation where the neuroscientist directly caused me to choose to kill some individual for personal gain. And then a second case where they set up the conditions earlier in my life that determined me to later in life have this egoistic desire and then choose to kill this individual for personal gain. And then you could go to a more prosaic kind of manipulation where I'm manipulated or brainwashed by a community of people. Think about someone like an occult that, or someone who's raised as a white supremacist. The people in their community brainwash them to have certain beliefs and desires and psychological states, and then they make these choices based on that manipulated psychology. And the argument is that the agent isn't free in any of these manipulated cases, because ultimately what they did is the result of factors beyond their control. And then the argument, the last step of the argument, is to say there's no relevant moral distinction between these cases of manipulation and the cases of ordinary determinism. And because in both cases, what is ultimately undermining the agent's responsibility is that their actions were the result of factors beyond their control. So if they're not responsible in the manipulated case, they shouldn't be held morally responsible in the case of ordinary determinism, because again, in the case of ordinary determinism, what they do is ultimately the result of their inner psychological states, right? I agree with Ryan that the compatibilist account, that what distinguishes it is that it says, I make some choice. My choice is preceded by some deliberation. Mm-hmm. And that deliberation is determined by the balance of my inner psychological states, my wants, my desires, my preferences. And the compatibilist essentially is saying, as long as that causal chain goes through those mechanisms within the agent, we should hold them responsible. What the manipulation cases show, or at least they make vivid, is that those inner psychological states themselves are causally determined. Whether they're causally determined by an external manipulator or they're causally determined by my upbringing and my past and my childhood and my brain chemistry, they're caused. And if the compatibilist is saying agents could be free and determined at the same time, and yet we have this really strong intuition that they're not free and morally responsible in the manipulated cases, we should have the same conclusion in the case of ordinary determinism. Because the only difference is how those inner states became determined. But that shouldn't be relevant, really, because ultimately the compatibilist view is that agents can be determined by their inner psychological states and still be held morally responsible. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's good. So I'll try. So this is one of the hardest arguments, I think, for the compatibilist to deal with is, So what the compatibilist has to do is argue that there is some difference between being determined by another agent and just ordinary.
Well, let me just jump in. There are some that go the other way.
That's true. Yeah. So I guess the two.
There's a hard line reply that says, no, they're responsible even in the case of external manipulation. But go ahead.
That's right. Yeah. And so actually, I think sometimes, so yeah, so I like McKenna's work on this stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And so like in part of my dissertation, I go through that and I say, and I kind of argue, like, depending on how you spell out the exact details of the count, sometimes the hard line reply would be the appropriate one. So sometimes like just bite the bullet and say, yep, even though there is some weird external manipulation going on here, the agent satisfies the conditions and is responsible. But like with that really extreme case, like let's start with the most extreme, most overt manipulation. In that kind of case, it seems like the agent just kind of isn't in control at all. Like the agent is just the agent is a puppet of another agent. And so part of the problem there is this is something else that a lot of compatibilist accounts will bring into it, like Fisher and Revisa, is an ownership condition on the mechanisms that produce your behavior. What seems to me is driving the intuitions there is that someone else is in charge of the mechanisms, not you. There's some other agent who's in charge of the mechanisms. And so especially in that most extreme version of the case, like even if I, you know, so let's say the agents are like trying to manipulate me to rob a bank or something, and they want me to keep robbing banks. The neuroscientists like are making me rob banks. They want me to get a bunch of money for whatever reason. So in that case, even if counterfactually I stopped and reflected on it and decided, you know what, I don't actually have good reasons to rob these banks. What would ordinarily be an ability to have that kind of control over my character over time, where I can reflect on my desires and take steps to change which desires are going to lead me to action, could not even counterfactually be causally effective there, because the neuroscientist will just come in and say, oh, well, we don't like that line of reasoning and where that's going. We'll zap that and make sure it steers back towards however they want to do it. But they're gonna mess with my brain and make sure it steers back towards robbing the bank. I think what's driving the intuition is the presence of the other agents. Not that it's being traced to something outside of my control, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So we could get to the other cases in a sec. So there's a couple things I guess I would want to say here. So one thing is there are ways to come up with, and I come up with a case in my book, Rejecting Retributivism, mm-hmm. where we don't have to have an external agent. Yeah. So you could imagine a case where, like, so let's say someone with Parkinson's has a brain implant to disrupt mm-hmm. their tremors. Yeah. And the device is meant, you know, for this therapeutic purpose, right? Not to manipulate agents, right? Uh-huh. But let's say there's some kind of, like, misfire in the computer, some kind of a cat walks across the keyboard, yeah. or just there's a glitch in the system. Yeah. And it temporarily in the agent causes a egoistic desire that's consistent with the mm-hmm. agent's preferences. The yeah. agent would approve of this preference of themselves, right? Fits mm-hmm. satisfies all the capacity. There's no external yeah. agent. We seem to satisfy some kind of ownership, and yeah. we don't have this external manipulator. And mm-hmm. yet, I think most people's intuitions is still this agent shouldn't be held responsible.
Yeah.
There's a second reply I would just throw in to respond to both. Mm-hmm. I'm familiar with kind of Fisher's thing here about the ownership condition. Mm-hmm. One is there's two ways to reply to this. I mean, one is like it could be begging the question just because you mm-hmm. build it in as a kind of post hoc way to get around manipulation cases. But the other way is just like in the second case of Pierre Boom's four case analogy, where you set up the conditions earlier mm-hmm. in the individual's life. It does seem this satisfies the ownership condition. Mm-hmm. And because over time, the agent is approving of these aspects of themselves, mm-hmm. they have time to adjust and yet they have ownership over the mechanisms, and yet it's all being manipulated from an initial set of conditions.
Yeah.
So if you're familiar with L. Mealy's zygote example, right, that's mm-hmm. a case where some angel sets up earlier in one's life. Yeah. They pick the sex cells, the zygote, what makes up the individual's DNA, and then they control, mm-hmm. like Truman, right, the initial you know, characters and people that I, you know, who I go to first grade with, who my second grade teacher was, who becomes my best friend in third grade, and all of this is sort of designed so that I like rob a liquor store on my 21st birthday. And these, you know, the team of angels are really good at what they do, and just as they had planned 21 years earlier, I rob this liquor store, and I do so on mechanisms I own and approve of, and I'm responsive to. And yet I think still many people have this really strong intuition that the agent lacks the kind of sourcehood I think that's needed in this particular case, the ground control. But
I'll take the zygote argument first. So the zygote argument, I'm kind of two minds about this, but that's one where I'm kind of inclined just to take the hardline reply there and say like, yeah, okay, like if the person went through in their normal life and just like a normal agent, like spent their whole life, like, you know, reflecting on their desires and crafting their character and thinking in some instances, like, okay, I'm going to reinforce this desire. I'm not going to reinforce this desire. I'm going to accept this reason and try and guide my behavior.
Of course,
the
reasons why they approve of one desire and another is itself causally determined.
It's all causally determined, of course. Yeah. I'm totally fine with that. But but over the course of their life, they still have exerted a kind of control over the kind of person that they became. It just so happens the whole thing was set in motion by this angel who wanted me to rob a bank on my birthday, but. I still feel like, the angel is to blame, and also I'm to blame. Like I'm kind of okay. Taking the hard line in that case.
Yeah.
I was just going to say, I think it's really, I don't know, actually, I'd be, maybe interested in some studies on this, but I think that, I suspect, right, that a lot of people would hear the team of angels, you know, making sure who you were going to go to first grade with and all that stuff, right? That like, you know, given the thought, well, if the bank robber had gone to different people gone to school with different people and had different experiences and this and that and the other thing had been true, then they might not have done that, right? That they could have that thought, right? So they in other words, the thought of, you know, causal determinism, at least loosely, right, is already there, and still have the intuition that they're responsible for that, right? But that you throw in the team of angels, right? You know, and even though it's the same mechanism after that, right? Like the, you know, that still pulls against the intuition that you're responsible, which does. You know, which I guess is what Ryan was getting at with saying like, okay, like what's really driving the intuition here, right? I mean, is the reason that we think that the team of angels, right, having set all this up, right, is responsibility destroyed? If it is, right, is the determinism, right? You know, that there's this chain of causes that lead you to do what you do. Or is the reason that there's the team of angels, right? Is the reason the presence of another agent? And I understand the Parkinson's thing was meant to undermine that, right? That, you know, that's
So what I would say is the unifying thing that undermines it, the moral responsibility in all the cases, is that it traced back to causes beyond the control of the agent. And that includes the external manipulators, but it also includes the kind of cases of natural determinism.
Yeah.
I mean, if I could respond to the hardline reply, I mean, I guess there's...
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I would say, you know, it's a couple of things. I mean, one is it's just a battle of intuitions, and I don't want to get into a battle of intuitions. And but I don't think the incompatibilist has to rely wholly on intuitions here. I mean, the argument could just be something like whatever sourcehood is, at the end of the day, this is like by definition a case that lacks the appropriate kind of sourcehood. And whatever it is that, you know, the agent lacks in this case, then that's the kind of sourcehood that's needed for responsibility. The other thing, though, I think is more convincing, and this is sort of coming from Pierre Boom as well, is what's the right initial kind of psychological stance to take in these manipulation cases. So the hardliner is basically arguing in the inverse, The hardliner says, like, let's take the four case argument, right? And they sort of say, well, the hard line is the agent is morally responsible, even in the most extreme case of manipulation, when the neuroscientist trigger in me this egoistic desire and I kill this person. Yeah. And then they agree there's no relevant distinction between these cases of manipulation and the case of normal, you know, normal determinism, and therefore conclude that the agent in the case of normal determinism is also morally responsible. I say that that's question begging. Right? I should say the opposite direction. The hard incompatibilist reasoning, the compatibilist hardline response, kind of the opposite. In the case of natural determinism, since agents are free and morally responsible, and there's no relevant difference between these agents and the case of manipulation, they're morally responsible in these cases. That seems to be begging the question, because the question we were after is whether or not agents in the case of normal determinism are actually free. So I think that the appropriate stance to take is a kind of neutral inquirer kind of position. Mm-hmm. Which says we're not committed to whether determinism is compatible or incompatible with free will and moral responsibility. And what we allow in the manipulation type argument, whether it's the four case argument or the zygote or any, is to allow these cases to clarify our intuitions. Mm-hmm. And there, I think it's a harder stance to take the hardline reply, because there's no in principle footing you have for saying this agent is responsible, other than your commitment that they're responsible in the case of natural determinism.
Yeah, so I think
that made sense. I didn't articulate as well.
No, I think I got what you're saying. So I think the compatibilists, who, even if they want to take the really hardline reply in the like intense manipulation case, and so like, yeah, so there's like that kind of like, we'll do the four case argument in reverse. I think they can do better than begging the question. So I think you can appeal to a lot of like common kinds of examples where we're fully aware that people are causally determined, and we still find things that they do praiseworthy or admirable
That's begging the question, though, because those are the cases where that's what's philosophically in dispute. We might naturally feel that way, but whether those emotions are justified or not, and maybe this will get us into the reactive attitude stuff.
This is getting back to like my starting point is to like look at us in our relationships with people and the attitudes that constitute those relationships. And say, okay, like those are kind of internally justified, right? So things like love and resentment and praise and blame are like they're built into our friendships and our loving relationships and our family relationships. And we all kind of, and we all kind of recognize it, at least in some cases, like these things are very determined, like a mother who, loves her child and makes huge sacrifices for her child. I think most people are just of course, like this is just something biological. It's innate. This is what mothers tend to do. And like, so the mother who does that is probably causally determined. But that doesn't in any way like threaten our sense that it's appropriate to praise her for what she's doing and admire her for what she's doing.
Yeah, I feel like we moved off though into this argument.
Yeah, sorry. I just wanted to say like there's a starting point where I think the compatibilists can like make some arguments to say why like on the far end of the four case, like the ordinary causal determinism, why we should regard these agents as being praiseworthy and blameworthy for what they do. Not just assert it or beg the question.
Okay. So the reason I'm jumping in is because, I mean, there is this really interesting methodological dispute about whether our sort of ordinary intuitions about things that, things that people do that might be causally determined in the normal way are sort of fair game as part of what should drive our views of, stuff like the four case argument, or whether we should sort of put that aside for the sake of neutrality while we're trying to decide, because that's the issue. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure there's a lot that could be said about that. If you guys wanted to do like a 4-hour debate about this, I would totally watch it. Right. and I would even stream it back here later, because we're not going to do that now. I do want to switch gears a little bit because I don't want this to get lost in this. Right. So I think people have, I hope at this point, a little bit of a sense of what the respective positions are, of what Ryan thinks is necessary for free will, why and sufficient, you know, for free will, why Greg doesn't think that would be sufficient for free will, and a little bit of, at least a little taste of how the debate actually proceeds about these positions. But since I know it's something that Greg has a lot to say about, and I want to make sure we get to it, I want to switch gears a little bit to a slightly different question, you know, for the last part of this today, right? Which is, okay, let's assume for the sake of argument that Greg is right, right? They, so the 4-hour debate happens, and we're all convinced by Greg about the that there's no such thing as moral responsibility. given that, right? What are the takeaways? You know, because I think this is a separate debate. I think it's important to keep it separate, right, analytically. But I think it's just really interesting, and it's something that I know Greg has a ton to say about, right? What are the takeaways for ordinary behavior, for how to think about punishment and the justification for punishment? Like what's the you know, if Greg is right, should we be disturbed by that? Should we like celebrate it because now, you know, now we actually have a reason to do all sorts of, you know, like things that are nice and humane anyway? Like what's the, you know, Greg, you want to kind of start us up on some of this?
Yeah. And I'm actually interested to hear what Ryan thinks here, because you don't necessarily have to all be pessimistic about the view, but I assume we might be. I'm an optimistic skeptic, so I call myself a free will skeptic, but I also think the implications, the practical implications of free will skepticism are not things to be feared, that life without free will is not only possible, but preferable. And so I'm actually optimistic about the implications, both in our interpersonal context, our relationships, and also in the realm of, say, criminal justice. And part of my optimism is based in the idea that although it's traditionally thought that, you know, we really need to retain things like resentment and indignation and moral anger and blame, or to quote the title of my book, Redenda, in it, the concept of just desserts, not deserts of what we eat after dinner, but the idea that some people deserve fundamentally and intrinsically blame and punishment, as well as praise and reward, that, you know, and Dennett thinks we need to preserve this notion of just desserts, that he says several times, if we were to give it up, we'd end up in a Hobbesian state of nature where life is solitary, poor, nasty, gruesome, and short. And I sort of say, like, you know, one, I just don't know why people think this. Because I've never actually myself, even before I was convinced of the view, never really thought that was would be the case. But second, it's an empirical question, of course. And so I don't think anyone should be overly confident. But I'm more optimistic about the prospects of what life would be like. And this is partly because I think the notion of just desserts is too often used to justify like excessively punitive forms of criminal justice, to encourage sort of treating people in severe and demeaning ways, even perpetuating economic inequality and sort of the notion of blaming the victim. Like if you're in poverty, you somehow deserve to be in poverty because you should have been able to pull yourself up from the bootstraps and overcome your circumstances. Oh, and if you succeeded in life, it was all your own doing. It wasn't because your father gave you a trust fund and started you off with $3 million or whatever Trump and others, you know, people ended up getting. And so part of it for me is like, I just fundamentally disagree with Ryan, I think, about the need to preserve these reactive attitudes in our interpersonal relationships. Like take moral anger, for example. Moral anger, yes, it plays a current really important role in our interpersonal relationships, but it also is quite often corrosive to our interpersonal relationships and counterproductive for the forward-looking purposes that I think Ryan and I and Dennett and everyone else sort of agree should be the goal, which is moral formation of agents, turning our children into the kind of moral agents we want them to be, you know, protecting society, making us safer, and reconciliation with people who harmed us in some sort of way. Moral anger often stands in the way of reconciliation. It often is counterproductive from a pedagogical style or from a parenting style. I mean, think of teachers. You know, I think often of the example of an art critique, because I used to be chair of our humanities department that included the art faculty. So students put their artwork up in the front of the class, and people ask them to, you know, why'd you make these choices? Why'd you use yellow instead of red or something? I think that there are kinds of moral responsibility that are consistent with giving up free will, and they're forward-looking accounts. So I'll come back to this in a second. But the idea that you can engage someone in a kind of moral conversation, why did you make the choice you made? You could, I think you could preserve axiological judgments of good and bad and right and wrong. And so I could ask my daughter, why did you do this thing in school? Do you think this was the right thing to do? What kind of choices can you make in the future that would be different? You think there's some fact about yourself that may have led you to make this choice? Do you think maybe we could work for changing that feature of yourself? I think that's all consistent in a way that the art critique would be. You ask, why did you choose to use yellow? Or why did you choose this shape? Could we choose a different shape? And you're moving pedagogically toward this forward-looking goal of, in this case, artistic development or moral development. I think almost all of us agree that a teacher exerting some kind of reactive attitude of resentment or indignation or moral anger at an aesthetic choice would be unjustified. And yet in the context of moral cases, we think it's totally justified. But we could see whether or not I think it's unjustified in both cases, but I could say what you could often see from the aesthetic case is that pedagogically it would be harmful. Right? Not only would it be unjustified for the teacher, the professor to blame the person for choosing yellow, or get, you know, angry at them for having made an aesthetic choice. It would prevent that person from learning from that choice and perhaps developing and changing themselves moving forward. And so I think moral anger often gets this kind of corrosive attitude in this interpersonal context. I'll just say one last thing. On the empirical grounds, I would say that I grant this, that we haven't really had many societies that have, you know, become model examples of what the skeptical world would look like. That said, and I think this is a really important point that often doesn't get talked about in the Strawsonian literature, is I think there might be a weird assumption going on in Strawson. I want to write a paper, I will write this paper eventually, called The Weird Moral Psychology of Strawsonians, where I'm sure Ben is familiar with this term of weird. It's a social psychological term that was developed to point to the fact that, like, all these studies done on human nature that tell us, oh, human nature is one way or another, are all done on weird populations, weird, like, in Western, educated, industrial, rich, and democratic.
Yeah, so they're all, like, it's all Western college students. Yeah,
yeah, they're all Stanford and Harvard and Cornell undergrads. Yeah. And then we say human nature is such because we ran some prison experiment at Stanford, right? The idea, though, is that these populations are weird in two senses. They're weird not only because they're just Western, industrial, educated, rich, democratic. They're weird because Western, educated, industrial, rich, democratic nations are outliers in the historical context of our species. They're more the exception than the norm. And what I would say is, when Strawsonians assume that these reactive attitudes, and not all reactive attitudes are under dispute, the only ones that are really under dispute are the ones that presuppose basic deserve, resentment, indignation, moral anger, retributive reactive attitudes, might be weird assumptions. It might be a weird assumption that we can't live without these. And I think that if you were to look at, to borrow a term from Owen Flanagan, the kind of moral variation of what he calls moral ecologies that have developed over time in different civilizations. Think of things like honor cultures. Honor cultures have a completely different set of moral practices than Western individual moral responsibility systems. So in an honor culture, if Ben harms my family in some way, two things have to occur. I, the victim, have to be the one who retaliates, not some third party justice like we have in our society, where the criminal justice system or the legal system would be doing the retaliation to the wrongdoer. I have to do it, because if I don't do it, I'm somehow vulnerable to the future and will be just a victim, and people will think they could just take advantage of me. And second, anyone on Ben's tribe, you know, your friends, your family, anyone on your team is a legitimate target. It doesn't have to be the wrongdoer. And so it's not tracking responsibility or individual blame in any way, right? And this honor culture evolved because it worked. It worked in the practical sense of worked for its moral ecology. The moral ecology of honor cultures tended to be cultures with no stable third-party justice. There was no strong state to administer justice. So the individual had to administer justice, otherwise they would become, you know, susceptible to further victimization. And it works in these small little societies. Now, we've abandoned honor cultures, and I think that's good. I'm not defending honor cultures here. They're terrible in many ways. But that's just to say that we might be short-sighted in assuming the Straussian weird assumptions about our individualistic system of moral responsibility is the only game in town. Yeah. And that if we were to abandon it, all society would crumble. I think that that is too much of a weird assumption, and that when you actually do cross-cultural studies of different societies and how they've viewed moral psychology, you might realize that there's more variation and variability that's possible. And therefore, if that's true, the optimistic skeptic can say there might be better ways of living. There might be better ways of organizing our individual personal relationships that might work more effectively, be more humane, possibly more justified if I'm right philosophically, and not be harmful, might actually produce better outcomes in this forward-looking sense.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I was super interested, you got into the thing that I would most like to argue with you about if we had time, but I'll just refer people to the episode with David Pizarro that we did, Ajia Cohen, because which is the relationship between the sort of economic inequality issue and the control and responsibility issue, right? I think the Cohen argument is going to be that it's like the other way around, right? That you sort of need that distinction to make sense of what's so objectionable about the kinds of inequality that we have. But like I said, I'll just refer people to that because we really do need to wrap up the segment in the next 5 minutes. So, Ryan, do what you can in 5 minutes.
Okay. 5 minutes. Okay. There's a lot to respond to here. So I very quickly want to say this. So I'm in a weird position here where I do think we lose some important things if we lose, these reactive attitudes. But I'm not like Dennett, where I think that throws us into a Hobbesian state of nature. So I really admire your work on this stuff, you and Pearbaum and a lot of these other guys. In some ways it has changed my thinking on something. So like, I do think there are things we can change and should change. Like, I want to move away from retributivism in the criminal justice system. Like, I think that would be a good thing to do. But I do still think there's an essential role for some basic deserved responsibility in the criminal justice system as well. So I'm trying to think what to focus on here in my 2 minutes. I agree with your examples, like it would be bad pedagogy to use moral anger in the art critique days. Also probably generally bad to rely on moral anger much with parenting. Like, that's not the best way to morally educate a child. But I do think moral anger still plays some like really essential roles in our relationships. So for example, especially with people who are victims. And so like one of the things interesting about both of those examples is the teacher and the parent is the person in power. I take this from like Michelle Curie and some other people recently who say, you know, like if you're in a position of power, you're kind of less entitled to rely on moral anger, but people who are oppressed, moral anger actually plays an important role for them. And it can be powerful. It can be motivating. It can be a powerful way to communicate what the oppressors are doing wrong. So I do think moral anger plays some roles. But where I think we really get some losses is in other attitudes related to anger. So things like regret, things like forgiveness, things like real apology. I think these attitudes are really important to relationships. And I agree, like there probably are a lot of ways we can set up societies that instantiate these things in very different ways. But these seem like really essential features. And I know some skeptics want to argue we can still maintain corollaries of these attitudes that would be close enough. But I'm somewhat skeptical of that. So I think that we probably like to go back to the manipulation argument, like, so, you know, we're assuming you're right that manipulation is really analogous to just ordinary causal determination. If I learned that someone was really manipulated, thoroughly manipulated by neuroscientists, and when they did something wrong to me, it wouldn't make sense for that person to apologize. And it would no longer make, I mean, it wouldn't make sense for me to be angry, but also wouldn't make sense for me to forgive them. It wouldn't really make sense for them to apologize and just be like, well, you know, it's the neuroscientist that did it, not you. And if you're right that the laws of physics and determinism are analogous to that, then it seems like we lose a whole lot of stuff.
So I could see that Greg really wants to argue with that about that. I suspect that there's enough to go on there to go back and forth about this this for a long time. I hope, in fact, we could actually do a part two of this at some point.
I would love to do a part two. I'd especially love to dive into Greg's views of justice and his quarantine
model. Yeah, I didn't even get the punishment.
Which I think is really interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's, I think that's actually maybe once you kind of let go, which I actually agree that you should, you know, let go of the idea that, like, you know, we're just going to have, you know, whatever, people eating each other and, you know, doubt is up and dogs and cats are going to be living together. Yeah. You know, if you don't have these concepts, I think, you know, that's probably a little much, right? You know, I think there's a more interesting argument to be had about what the effect would be about how we think about criminal justice, what we think about stuff like inequality and like the good and bad things about that. And I would really like to have both of you back on to talk about that stuff. But Greg, one last quick point.
Yeah, I'm not going to respond to Ryan. I'll just plug something for further reading. Dirk Peerboom and I have a forthcoming little book. It's like 3,000 words, 30,000 words. It's part of a Cambridge Element series. They're free and they're open source and open access. It should be out, I don't know, hopefully in a couple of months. More Responsibility Skepticism. And we're going to, part of it is actually sort of getting to the questions of Ryan. So I'll just say readers could check it out. Like, we do argue that you could preserve things like self-guilt and apology, and certain things make sense even without basic dessert. But I'll just plug in instead of make the arguments and say, maybe we could have this conversation again.
Cool. All right. Yeah. All right. Yeah. Awesome.
Well, let's 100% for sure do that. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Ryan. Thank you, Greg. Should.
Thanks, Greg. This was a blast. Thank you.
Yeah. It's always fun.
You should check out Greg's book. We've got a link to one of them in the description. We'll do the link to the book with Peerboom too. You should I don't know, Ryan draws comics and shit. You should check that out. So we will leave it there for tonight. So thank you, Ryan. Thank you, Greg. So we're going to bring on Jen for the final segment and then go to the post game for patrons. So we should be done with the main show and go to the post game. We're running a little bit late, but we should be going to the post game in like 10, 15 minutes. I am going to set up what we're talking about in the segment with Jen. I am going to play, this is just going to be a screen share, but I'm going to play a little bit that people might remember from one of the greatest hits of GTA Season 3, I'm talking with a good friend of the show about the Euthyphro, because in the segment with Jen we're going to talk about something else that's from that same dialogue by Plato, the Euthyphro, but this is just to jog people's memory about what the main thing going on there is. We'll do that for about 10 minutes. Then we're going to go to the post game with Kuba and Jason from This Is Revolution. Should be a lot of fun. As a reminder, to be able to access that and every other post game and all the other great stuff that patrons get at our Undying Love and Gratitude, go to patreon.com/BenBurgess. All right. So here is this. It is a little bit it's a little bit off the track of most of what we've been talking about, but I have been wondering about this, right?
Sure.
Because I have seen I've seen some of your previous previous debates, and something's come up at a couple of them. It's not a politics question at all, at least directly.
Is it more metaphysics?
It's more metaphysical question. Is I've seen you make this claim that, you know, you'll say things like, well, there's no social contract, our rights come from God.
Yes.
So first thing is, could you elaborate a little bit on what you mean by that?
Yeah, just as the founders did, as they said in the Declaration, the laws of nature and nature's God, where whether you believe it's an actual being of a triune God like I would, or kind of more of a deistic type God, that you have rights since something gave it to you, and that the social contract that we have recognizes a transcendent order.
So if something gave it to you, I assume that what you mean by something gave it to you,
I would believe an omniscient, omnipotent being, but I'm not proselytizing you to believe that.
I don't think you are. I mean, I was the one who brought it up. I'm
sure.
Just curious.
Okay, no.
Because when you say that something gave it to you, you could read that at least two different ways. So one of them is, and I assume this is not what you think, but one of them is that, like, literally in a cause and effect way, we have certain legal rights because of, like, the intervention of God. But of course, it's clearly not the case that God is, like, stopping China from putting dissidents in jail. I assume what you mean is that we morally have a right to those things because God gave it to you.
That's correct. But if you're asking, do I believe that in a God that can intervene supernaturally, I do.
Sure, you can. But I mean, like,
I'm happy to get into that.
Sure, fair enough, right? I don't think that's actually relevant to the question.
Yeah.
But trust me, whatever else I am, I'm a huge philosophy nerd. I'm always happy to talk about that.
And I have a question about Christopher Hitchens for you.
Sure, awesome.
Because I know you wrote a book on
it. I did. Just finished a couple weeks ago. But thank you. If you say that God is the moral, is the reason why morally we should have these rights,
the unmoved mover.
That I don't understand how that's going to get around, like, the Euthyphro problem. Like, if you say, okay, so Euthyphro, there's this dialogue written by Plato where Socrates is arguing with this ancient Greek holy man named Euthyphro, and they're talking about the definition of holiness. And it's going to take just a second, but I promise I'm going to get through this quickly and we'll get to the point. They're arguing about the definition of holiness, and Euthyphro says the holy is that which the gods love, and Socrates asks him this simple question. Do the gods love it because it is holy, or is it holy because the gods love it? So translated into what we're talking about here, the question would be, is it morally just that, these rights be recognized because that's what God wants, or does God want it because it would be morally unjust to deny them? Because if you say
both. That was such a great ending part.
All right. So
hi, Jay Andrew.
That was Charlie Kirk famously solving what we call the Euthyphro problem in an odd and unexpected way in the debate that I had with him last year. And we've been doing this little series of for the philosophy segments, and this episode, kind of the whole episode's a philosophy segment.
But, get up here where I'm even with you, not like to the back and the side, like some sort of servant.
Wow. for the Dr. Jen philosophy segment, since we have been we've been doing this little series on Plato's dialogues, I thought it might be interesting to do one about Euthyphro, which you just heard me describe to Charlie Kirk, but not about the Euthyphro problem.
Thank God.
As interesting as that is, which we, as we talked about that extensively in the past, but about something else that's in the Euthyphro. Want to do this quickly, but I thought this was really interesting. So,
finals are on. We need to get a move on here.
That and or the post game. So when Euthyphro tells Socrates that holiness and piety is that which the gods love, before he even gets to the gods love it because you know, because it's pious, or is it the other way around? Socrates raises a different objection. He says, okay, but do the gods all agree with each other? I thought the gods went to war with each other sometimes. You know, we were talking about the Avengers earlier, you know, stuff like that in there. So then, and Euthyphro says, oh yeah, that's right, they do. And they kind of go back and forth about a little, maybe it's the stuff all the gods agree on, you know. And there, Jake, do we have the graphic? There's this really interesting exchange. So Socrates says, here, you want to do Socrates or Euthyphro?
Euthyphro.
All right. I'll be Socrates. What are the subjects of difference that cause hatred and anger? Let us look at it this way. If you and I were to differ about numbers as to which is the greater, would this difference make us enemies and angry with each other, or would we proceed to count and soon resolve our difference about this?
We would certainly do so.
All right, let's get the next.
Wow, that's small.
Again.
My bifocals.
Again. If we differed about the larger and the smaller, we would turn to measurement and soon cease to differ.
That is so.
And about the heavier and the lighter, we would resort to weighing and be reconciled.
Of course.
What subjects of difference would make us angry and hostile to each other if we were unable to come to a decision? Perhaps you do not have an answer ready, but examine, as I tell you, whether these subjects are the just and the unjust, the beautiful and the ugly, the good and the bad. Are these not the subjects of difference about which, when we are unable to come to a satisfactory decision, you and I and other men become hostile to each other whenever we do?
That is the difference, Socrates, about those subjects.
What about the gods, Euthyphro? If indeed they have differences, will it not be about these same subjects?
It certainly must be so.
Yeah. All right.
That's how we talk around here.
Yeah.
Yes, Ben, that is so. It certainly must be so, Ben.
Yeah, I don't hear. I don't recall a lot of that, to be honest. But, and this is really interesting for a lot of reasons, one of which is, all right, Plato was writing this dialogue like 24 or 5 centuries ago, something like that.
Long time ago.
Yeah, a long time ago. All right. Long time ago. All right. So, and you think, like, you know, not very much of that time ago in the greater scheme of things, right? The 18th century, you have David Hume, who famously talks about the fact-value distinction, the gap between is and ought, that there are, you know, there are facts, which are how the world is, there are values, which are about, you know, how things should be, and that you can't logically get to the how things should be from how they are. yeah, no, if only Socrates had a YouTube operation like what Ben Shapiro has in the Daily Wire, so he could do little clips of all these, you know, he would have been much more popular in Athens and they wouldn't have killed him. And what Socrates, you know, Plato, right, through Socrates is pointing out in this dialogue seems a whole lot like the fact-value distinction, a good, you know, whatever, however many, you know, 20 and change.
Long time ago.
Centuries before Hume, which is interesting, right? So he's pointing out the difference between these two kinds of subjects. Socrates thinks we don't argue about, we don't get mad at each other about facts.
Socrates has never met my in-laws, but, you know.
To be fair, I don't think they really get angry at each other about facts, but there is a lot of, like, you know.
Ben and I, we're sitting at the dinner table, and there, you know, it was on First Street. No, Kathy, it was on Second Street. And Ben and Al catch each other's eye across the table. Like, there they go again.
Yeah, I always think, why don't you just take out your phone and check, right? but
they're so cute.
But in any case, Socrates thinks we don't get mad at each other about those things, right? You know, we get angry at each other about values, because with facts, you know, sometimes it might be hard to check. And I think if we're going to be realistic about this, you know, you're just not going to get total consensus about facts, you know, that people with different points of view and different biases and assumptions are going to come to different factual.
We are in a post-fact society.
Yeah, we could break down whether that's true or in what sense. But the, but yeah, I mean, like, I don't know. I mean, I think, people, like, you are going to get a lot of political disagreements are going, there's going to be an element where you disagree about facts, right? Like, what's going to happen if you raise the minimum wage, is that going to lead to more unemployment or not? Think about people who supported or opposed the Iraq War would disagree about how seriously to take the weapons of mass destruction or whatever. But it is true that a lot of the deepest disagreements are deep disagreements about values.
Sure. So,
all right. I guess we are going to do the quite so Socrates
thing. Quite so, Ben. Quite so, Dr. Burgess. Wow.
I never hear this. Okay. So, which does, I think, tie into something that's interesting. I want to maybe end the episode on, right, this point, which is sometimes people will say, look, what's the point of, remember I just advertised earlier on, I have that debate coming up in New York with James O'Keefe and Tim Pool and Tulsi Gabbard. And I think, okay, this is just this gallery of, whatever. Why are you trying to think how to put this? I don't want the debate to be called off because of anything I say right now. But
gallery of loons?
Gallery of something. And they go, oh, come on, why are you doing this, right? You're not going to convince each other because there are these fundamental differences about values.
But are those the only people paying attention?
No, I don't think so, right?
They might be. is this going to be well attended, or is it just going to be y'all talking at each other?
Yeah, I mean, it's at the Beacon Theater. That's a huge venue. There's the Tulsi Gabbard, she was in Congress not that long ago. I think it's, for better or for worse, Tim Pool and James O'Keefe have big audiences.
Let me just say, Ben knows better than to disagree with me at the dinner table full of family. And no, I never get the fair enough. He will argue until he drops dead. So usually it's me, fair enough, man, fair enough.
Okay. So in any case, I think your question is real. Are those the only people watching? Right. So just quick example, it's almost 10:15. We've got to go to the post game, but they have, think about the clip that we ran last night on the YouTube channel, which is from Sam Cedar's debate with Yaron Brook from the Ayn Rand Institute. And they're talking about that condo collapse in Miami. And Sam kind of says, okay, but do you think this is at least a legitimate role for government, preventing things like this? And the Ayn Rand Institute guy says, no, they should have, tenants should have done a more careful investigation of the safety practices at the condo, before they moved there. And right. I mean, I think that's the reaction that most normal people are going to have to see that.
Did we get somebody out here to check our foundations when we moved into this apartment?
No, we just naively trusted that they're not going to kill us. This is quoted before the show. Liz Brunick, said once that, half the point of a debate is to get the other person to tell you what they really think. I think when you get these fundamental differences in values, that's actually really useful in terms of, the goal is never to convince the other person on the stage or the person on the split YouTube screen, that because realistically that's unlikely anyway, right? The goal is to convince whoever is convincible in the audience. And, if you have... if you get to the point where it's that was on the renters, they should have checked the foundations themselves. Murray Rothbard, I was a big libertarian thinker in the 20th century, has this line where he is, let me actually see if I can find that. So Jeet Kheer is a journalist I follow on Twitter. And he has been, he's writing something about Rothbard. So he's been posting these extremely interesting Rothbard quotes on Twitter. This is one of them. Murray Rothbard argued parents have the right to starve children to death. Here's the actual, you think, okay, he's exaggerating, right? Surely Rothbard didn't say that. Here's what he says. A plague, our theory, to parents and children. This means a parent does not have a legal right to aggress against his children, but also that a parent should not have a legal obligation to feed, clothe, or educate his children. Since such obligations entail positive acts coerced upon the parent and depriving the parent of his rights, the parent therefore may not murder or mutilate his child.
That, oh, wonderful.
Yeah, I know. That was big of him. And the law properly outlaws a parent from doing so. But the parent should have the legal right not to feed the child, i.e. to allow it to die. The law, therefore, may not properly compel the parent to feed a child or keep it alive.
That's appalling.
Yeah. And I think that's like a useful thing when you get to those basic disagreements. And it's like that, was it the line in the Old Testament, right? I've presented you this day, you know, life and death, you know what I mean? Not like you. You got some basic choices here, right? I mean, that's like, you're going to go with the, maybe we do actually do have positive rights, you know, food, clothing, healthcare, education. Or you could go the other way. What's it going to be, buddy? And, you know, that seems useful, man. Meanwhile, we are going to go to the post-game for patrons. So patreon.com/BenBurgess. If you're already a patron, you should already have that link in your inbox. So we're going to do that right now.
Team Snoopy forever.
Left is best.